Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with just one co-host, Aaron Lammer. How are you, sir?
Good. Tempted to go fart in Evan's chair while he's gone.
You've already done that a few times. I don't know why you have to pretend like you haven't done that. Evan is gone, but we are doing something for the first time on the show. We are introing an episode that neither of us did the interview.
Yeah.
Sort of stumbled through that sentence a little bit there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's innovative.
It is. Yeah. We're really doing the trip. Evan is not here, but Evan did do this interview, and it's with Eric Larson. He's a very exciting person to have on the podcast. And I've not listened to the interview yet.
I haven't either.
But I can tell you this. When Evan walked out of this interview,
yeah,
he gave me like a thumbs up.
And Evan is actually only allotted 3 moments of joy per year. So that means something.
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal. Eric Larson's probably best known for The Devil in the White City. He has a new book out. It's called Dead Wake. It's about the sinking of the Satania.
Spoiler alert.
sorry, that ship goes down.
That sounds excellent. I'm going to read that book. Do we have that book in the office here?
I think we do, yeah.
All right, I'm going to check that out. I'm going to take it straight from Evan's desk and not tell him.
Another book, you can take it from my desk, because I've already read it.
What's that?
It's our sponsor this week. It's Love and Other Ways of Dying. It's a new collection of essays from Michael Paterniti, one of our favorites around here.
Listen to his long-form podcast.
Yeah, his long-form podcast, also with Evan Ratliff, is fantastic. And so is the work in this book. Mike's been writing for magazines for, you know, I don't know, 20 years. And these are his best pieces.
One of the best.
Yeah, he really is. He is one of the best. He's also a completely unique writer. He does not sound like anybody else.
Some of his like really early work, like that Eating Jack Hooker's Cow story,
yeah,
is like almost like it's like the kind of thing that you would like someone would try to do in like a MFA workshop and it would go like horribly wrong, gone horribly right. Like a lot of his writing is he's really a very unique writer.
Yeah, I think he's probably...
That sounded insulting, but that's actually one of my favorite stories. It's like a dense, atmospheric, freeform...
Yeah, I think part of the reason that it reads that way to you is that a lot of people are trying to write like Mike Paterniti.
That is correct. That is correct.
Only Mike Paterniti writes like Mike Paterniti, and you should get this book. It's called Love and Other Ways of Dying, and thanks to Random House for sponsoring the show.
One thing I would say is that just as Mike Paterniti writes like only Mike Paterniti, you should write just like yourself. And what better way to develop your own writing style than starting a simple newsletter with Tiny Letter? You sign up. This is with MailChimp, who really knows the email newsletter game like no one else. But they've simplified their whole thing into this. You get a little sign-up form. People put in their email. You send them a newsletter. There's probably no better way to keep people up to date with your writing, what you're doing, than a Tiny Letter. Tons of writers use it. You don't have to be a writer, but I think it's really uniquely suited for writers. But even if you're not a writer, check it out today. They are our sponsor. They've been supporters of the show since the very beginning. Here is Evan with Eric Larson.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
You're Eric Larson. You're the author of, God, which one would you be most known for at this point?
Probably still most known for Devil in the White City.
Yeah, Devil in the White City.
The Garden of Beasts is catching up.
I heard you talk about this interview at some point, but I also heard from someone that you don't read reviews, that you legitimately, a lot of people say they don't read the reviews, and they probably do.
Right. I don't read reviews.
Period.
I don't read the reviews because, and actually I don't even read the positive reviews because, you know, there's always one phrase. There's always one phrase that will be rattling around in your head forever. And, you know, when you sit down to write something or to work on a new project, the last thing you need is this phrase or God forbid some really negative comment rotating around in your mind, because you know you gotta be totally present and there for any project you do, you know, whether it's a novel or a work of nonfiction, anything like that. There's one time that I broke that rule and I will never do it again. I was sitting in a hotel restaurant, you know, having breakfast. It was the ideal day. It was shaping up. Beautiful weather. This was for a book tour, and I was going to see my eldest daughter for the first time after sending her off to college. It was just really
shaping. Which book was this?
It was Thunderstruck. And so I was sitting there at the table, and I knew there was going to be a review in the Times on Monday, not the New York Times Book Review, but the Daily Times. And so I just thought, okay, I would look at it, you know, see what the headline said. It looked, well, that looks okay. Nothing threatening there. Read the first paragraph. I just about choked.
Yeah.
This particular reviewer did not like Thunderstruck, and it just ruined my day.
I think I read that review because I was reading some of the reviews recently.
And that particular reviewer has adored two of my books, hated that one. And that's, you know, that's her right. But it was hard that day. So I don't look at reviews. You know, people send me reviews. People send me things that other people have written. That's fine. I don't read them. They are so now on alert, and my agent and everything else, that even when all these sort of good things have been happening, they don't tell me. And so at one point I was talking to my publisher. I said, So, you know, how are things going? I mean, is it, you know, I just saw this thing on Twitter that said such and such, such and such. And she says, we've been on that for days. We're just not telling you.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's good.
Well, you're pretty active on Twitter. I would imagine that a lot of your fans follow you on Twitter, that you would not help but see, you know, people just tweeting out a headline of something that says like, Eric Larson nails it again, or...
Well, fortunately, that is going to be one element of Twitter that I'm going to have to deal with, because I'm not going to not read my Twitter feed.
Right.
You know? I mean, I love Twitter. This is like great fun, you know?
Yeah. So the other aspect I'm interested in, maybe we can get a little bit into the new book, in this idea of like, you know, the last three books that you've had, particularly two of them, have been very successful in terms of bestsellers. I mean, Devil in the White City was like on the bestseller list every time I ever looked at the New York Times book section for like a many year period. So it feels like there's probably kind of a little bit of a publicity machine around a book launch and a tour and a lot of interviews. And so I'm thinking about this almost in a meta sense, because I'm about to ask you a bunch of questions. You have to have like canned answers by a certain point, where 3 months from now you're going to have said the same thing about this book 100 times. And it's kind of reminds me of like the Rolling Stones, like going out and playing like the same thing over and over again. Like, is that fun for you, or is that just like part of the work?
Well, let's just say that I hope I can deliver as fresh answers as Mick Jagger can still deliver at his concerts. I mean, that guy's amazing. But, you know, I mean, to some extent, I don't have canned answers. That is to say that every time I answer a question, it's going to be different. And it depends, of course, on who's doing the interviews and so forth. But, yeah, there will always be certain stock questions that will be asked. And, you know, one standard question is like, what made you do this book? I'm probably anticipating things that you're going to ask me. But yeah, it's like, what made you do this book? Where do you get your ideas?
Where do you get your ideas?
And all that stuff. And I don't mind talking about that, because it's kind of fascinating to me. But now and then somebody will throw me a question that is like, yeah, really? Wow. Huh. I'm going to have to think about that one.
I feel like I'm getting in early on this one, so they're not cliche questions if I'm the first person to
be asking you the question.
But I was interested, just if it's possible to give a capsule. I mean, all I know about the book is this point, because you've kept it pretty well under wraps in terms of what exactly it's about, is that it's about the Lusitania. Right. And what interests me about that is that anybody who paid attention in high school history reasonably well, like, knows the Lusitania. It feels like a story. Yeah, not quite the Titanic, maybe, in its level of awareness, but people know something about it, which is maybe different than some of the previous books, which were, you pulled people out of obscurity and brought them back.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, the Lusitania is not typically the kind of thing that I mean, I find myself kind of surprised that I took it on to begin with, because it's not my kind of idea per se. I mean, I like ideas that are complicated. That is to say, something that, mainly because I like the idea of building in barriers to entry. That is, you know, I'll be working on this idea. Like, when I was working on Devil in the White City, I could be pretty confident that nobody else was going to do the same book. Mm. You know, because to me, the worst thing is that it's the hell of the dual review, where, you know, two books are reviewed simultaneously. Huh. Because invariably, you know, you start making comparisons, and one's going to be better than the other, or that's going to be the view of the, you know, and then you're just going to be dogged by this other book for the rest of your life.
Although you would never actually know about the review itself. You would only know that this book was following you around.
You would see the headline. you'd see, like, in the New York Times, two books. You know, yeah. The two books side by side. Right. You know, right, boy. Yeah. But you're quite right. I would definitely not read those reviews. But the thing about the Lusitania is that I have this maritime thing. You know, I love ships. Maybe it's my Scandinavian heritage. I don't know what it is, but it's always been rattling around in my head to at least look into the Lusitania. But I never did anything about it. You know, a lot of things have been done on the Lusitania. It's one of those things that might be described as like really low hanging fruit. And again, I typically try to avoid that kind of thing. But in this case, I suddenly realized, well, here's this anniversary coming. You know, this 100-year anniversary. And now we're talking about 5 years ago, you know, thinking ahead to May 2015. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being a former practicing journalist, it was like, well, okay, why write about something now? You know, why write about something now? And suddenly I had a reason, you know?
The anniversary.
Yeah. No, I don't like anniversaries typically as things to peg a book on because they're I don't think readers care, for one thing. But I started reading. And as it happens, the first book I read was very dramatic and very really sort of quite shocking. I've subsequently realized it has also been completely discredited. I don't want to identify the book.
But it was like scene by scene. You felt like, oh, someone's sort of done this.
It was more this sort of these really kind of outrageous revelations about what might or might not have been aboard the ship. And completely and utterly debunked by others subsequently, but it made a huge stink when it came out back in the 60s. And but I started reading about this, and I started thinking to myself, you know, what really drew me was the footnotes of that book, which were actually fairly skimpy. And then the next book I read, I came to realize that there was this really huge reservoir of archival materials available that I came to feel had not been adequately taken advantage of. Huh. This is a very interesting combination of material available that would make this for me an exercise in suspense. You know, I mean, the thing about narrative nonfiction is you got to keep it nonfiction. A lot of people don't get that who try to write narrative nonfiction, unfortunately. But it's got to be real, right? It's got to be the real deal. And to do that, you have to have the richest, deepest seam of material available, and you have to go the distance and hunt through it for every little teeny tidbit. In this case, there was so much available across such a wide spectrum that it made me, I really sort of saw in my mind's eye this way to tell the story with a lot of suspense, a lot of almost Hitchcockian suspense. I don't want to wear that mantle because nobody can except Hitchcock, but it just seemed like an exercise, a potential exercise in true storytelling.
And how far did you have to get into the archive before you said, like, how much is enough for you to say, this is my next book?
Well, I can tell you exactly when that was. After reading some of the tertiary, you know, the outer, you know, beltway of research materials, if you will, I invested in a trip down to Stanford University to the Hoover Institution. I have family down in the Bay Area anyway, so it was, you know, maybe this will be valuable, maybe not. Maybe it'll be a tax write-off, maybe not. You know, so I went down there and I was going through these materials. And I was like, wow, this is great, and here they are. You know, all this stuff was actually really close at hand. Also, just at, you know, the time being a full-time Seattleite at that point, it's a hop, skip, and a jump down to Stanford. And then the thing that cinched it, though, was I was sitting there at the table doing my research, and an archivist at the institution comes over. I didn't ask about it. She just brought it. She brings over this plank a piece of wood about 2 feet long, mm-hmm. with the Lusitania stamped in the wood. And this had been a fragment from a lifeboat that had been dashed onto the beach and broken up, and this fragment was found next to a dead passenger and somehow made its way over time into the archive at the Hoover Institution. Mm. I'm not really a terribly supernatural kind of guy, but I always look for signs that I'm on the right track, that something is telling me that this is actually going to be worthwhile pursuing, and that was the sign. It's like, wow, this is interesting. And then this sudden weird connection, this piece of wood from the Lusitania right there. And so I started looking into, looking into it more deeply, looking into other archives. Mm-hmm. And then when I realized that I had thought I knew something about the Lusitania, I realized, man, I didn't know anything. That also really, really helped. I mean, see, the thing about the Lusitania is, everybody came across it in high school, probably, in a survey history of European history.
Yeah.
Probably on a timeline node. It was one node on a timeline.
U-boat sinks, Lusitania.
War begins for America. That kind of thing. That also cuts to the idea of why it's been so overshadowed by the Titanic is because it seems to be more like a geopolitical artifact as opposed to this human saga of death on the sea. But when you read about what happened to the Lusitania, it's pretty grotesque and it's pretty amazing. The things that went on and the things that were actually known ahead of time about the submarine and where it was going to be just really became a great, great journey for me.
And even once you get into those archives, you're deep in them, you say, okay, there's a lot of material here. It strikes me that there's a possibility that the characters still might not emerge, or there might not be, the level of dialogue that you're producing from letters, from firsthand accounts, that it could be that aspect is missing, or the most interesting people don't have that, and some more boring people have that.
No, that's absolutely true, and that's always a danger. Like I immediately began honing in on the captain of the ship, William Thomas Turner, who proved to be something of a sphinx. We went sort of a classic old seaman, kind of taciturn and so forth. But enough on him to make him a vivid character. But from there on, the choice of character was really determined by critical mass of information that they left behind about the voyage. Because you've got to find these people to hold hands with through the whole voyage and through the whole experience. So, A, they have to have survived, because you're not going to get an account from a dead guy, B, there has to be a lot of information in that account. But C, there has to be something fundamentally interesting about the character, something to make that character worthwhile. So, that is very difficult. You don't know about that often until you're well into the research, until you've actually got a contract with the publisher, and that's always a risky thing. But you can make an educated guess before the book actually gets a contract.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things for a second, tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week, Wealthfront. Wealthfront is the automated investment service that makes it easy to invest your money the right way. Their software manages your money using investment strategies that were previously only available to the absolute wealthiest investors in the world, all for just a quarter of the cost of using a traditional advisor. Here's how they do their thing. Wealthfront monitors your account 24/7, automatically rebalancing your portfolio, reinvesting dividends, and working to maximize your after-tax returns. Wealthfront is also overseen by a team of investment experts, the same experts who launched the index fund revolution and who've written some of the most important books in finance. Some other things you should know. Wealthfront manages over $2 billion in client assets. That's billion with a B, and has saved millions of dollars on taxes for its clients. So here's what you should do. Go to wealthfront.com/longform. That's wealthfront.com/longform. And your first 10 grand will be managed for free. Some other things I should tell you, this is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there's possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. I should have read that very, very fast, but I didn't. That's okay. Thanks to Wealthfront for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to Evan and Eric.
You must have a very high tolerance for like solo research, like digging in and like just being lost in materials for years, really.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a high tolerance for being alone and sitting in an archive hour after hour. As long as there's a good bar at the end of the day, this is one of the things that's required if you travel, to an archive. It's got to be a decent hotel with a good bar. But it is never boring, because once I'm on the case, it really is kind of like a detective story. It's like I'm in one. Once I'm on the case, you just never know what you're going to find, but you know you've got to find a certain category of information, you know, something that will make my imagination come alive, mm-hmm. you know, something that screams to me, this is good. And the only way to find that is to put in the hours. But I'm very content to do it. Like if I spend, in the case of Devil in the White City, if I spend an entire day in an archive and all I discover is that the doctor who was in charge of this innovative ambulance service at the fair, is that his name was Gentles, G-E-N-T-L-E-S, Dr. Gentles. Here's this, you know, innovative ambulance service with rubber wheels so it wouldn't shake people and so forth, you know, that kind of thing. If I find little details, something like that, that will – or another case, in the case of Devil in the Wet City, was, you know, the fact that on the first turn of the Ferris wheel, all the loose bolts that had just been sort of left on the structure in the course of construction rained down on the cab, that the first cab that people were in that was going to take them around this whole wheel. Love that kind of detail. But you got to go the distance to find it. A full day could produce nothing. I mean, you know, really, I mean, I have like for this last book, for my newest book, Dead Wake, I mean, I have all my records are back in Seattle, but I have volumes and volumes of stacks and so forth of original documents and intercepted telegrams and love letters from, you know, President Wilson's girlfriend. And, you know, but what you're going to use of that is just a tiny frame, tiny 10%, 5%, you know, because, you know, if you've got 10,000 pieces of paper, and your book is your book is like, you know, 300 pages. Well, you do the math, you know. So.
Right. You mentioned being a former journalist or right. lapsed journalist or
former practicing journalist.
Former practicing journalist. That's a great way to describe it. And I am interested in how in the story of sort of you getting your start in that. And I read a little bit about it that you went to journalism school. Went to work for a small paper. What was that called?
The Bucks County Courier Times. Bucks County in Levittown, Times. Pennsylvania. Great place to start, let me tell you. Levittown was a little tough to be a single guy, you know, a young single guy, but but the paper was really good.
And from there to the Wall Street Journal?
I got extremely lucky. Yeah, I got passed over for a promotion at the Bucks County Courier Times, and actually it was a good thing I got passed over.
They didn't see your talent at the Bucks County Times?
Well, no. But actually what they saw was my lack of talent for a certain kind of reporting. I was writing features for the Sunday paper, and I really didn't know how good I had it because I was doing full page features and plenty of time to do them. It was really fun, you know, really good. But I, you know, the culture of the paper was more sort of toward, you know, hard news and so forth. And so this hard news spot had opened. I thought, yeah, I want to do that. And happily, they passed me over and hired somebody from the outside for that job. But it so ticked me off that I sent my resume to everybody I knew. And I knew somebody who had been working for the Wall Street Journal. She kindly passed it on to the bureau chief in Philadelphia back when there was a bureau of the Wall Street Journal there, and I got hired. It was just the biggest moment of my career was that moment when he called me. I was shaving at the time. He called me, and he said, "Well, looks like you're in." And I was like, "Oh my God."
And was that a feature writing gig? The
Wall Street Journal at that point, the Wall Street Journal at that point was, first of all, had a very different design. It had the classic journal design, which I in retrospect, I think I actually prefer. But everybody did feature stories if they came up with something that Page One wanted. But you also were obligated to spend a certain period of time doing hard news, or what's called spot news at the time. And you did that at 2 week intervals, 2 week rotations. And that was pure hell, let me tell you. I mean, it was really stressful. But then, you know, it bought you a certain amount of free time to work on feature stories. And I started kind of specializing in the so-called A-head, which was the story that that in the old design ran down the middle of the front page. They're still A-heads. They're just sort of less emphasized on the front page.
And they're a lot shorter. I remember a couple of years ago, someone did a graph of post-Rupert Murdoch A-head length,
really?
And it had gone down to like from, they were like 4,000 and 5,000 words sometimes or something.
Well,
they were down to like,
yeah,
1,000 words.
There was always
whatever.
A lot of pressure on A-heads to make them shorter than you actually wanted to write them. But the classic A-head was essentially four double-spaced pages.
Yeah.
But back in the day, you could spend a month working on that four-page piece. And that's why they were so good, because you just over-reported everything. And
yeah.
You found things that nobody else would ever find. So I just absolutely loved that. But yeah, so I had died and gone to heaven when I went to the Journal. That was just great. In fact, you know, I was working out of Philly and I loved Philadelphia. I really loved Philadelphia, the whole mob culture, and I was just, Philadelphia is an original, really original town. But because back then the culture was at the paper, if you did well, they tried to transfer you. You know, I did well, and they tried to transfer me to Detroit, which is, you know, Business Central, right?
Mm-hmm.
I turned it down.
Car industry.
Yeah, I turned it down, which you were not supposed to do. I thought my career was dead at that point. Then they offered me another transfer to L.A., and I turned that down, figuring my career is already dead. I don't want to go to L.A., you know, so there I am. And then they offered me another one in San Francisco, and I thought, I'll take it.
Yeah,
it was good. It was great.
And so how did you transition into, I mean, I went back and read some Atlantic pieces and Harper's pieces that you did that turned into, it seemed like, your earliest books. Or were excerpted from your earliest books, one or the other.
Yeah,
how did you transition to that?
Yeah, that's really a good question. You know, what happened was after I'd been working at the Journal for a while, I was getting kind of tired of writing journalism. You know, I was tired of I was tired of actually doing enough work to write a small book for each piece and have it last for a day, you know, mm-hmm. run in the paper and last for a day, you know what I mean? But also, of course, there was romance in my life. I'd met the woman who was then and who became and is still my wife, it was a blind date, believe it or not. And she was a physician in training, and she got offered this fantastic job at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And so I thought, okay, devil's bargain time. I will quit the Journal and work on other things. What I had in mind actually at the time was a novel. I have four incomplete novels in various places in my office. In
incomplete or complete and unpublished?
I'm sorry, complete. But unpublished, yeah. Did I say incomplete? Four complete novels.
Well,
they ain't complete until they're published, you know.
Yeah.
So four complete novels in my all, you know, sort of what I would like to consider literary detective stories. But anyway, so it was kind of a devil's bargain. And what I really didn't like was the fact that suddenly I had no what I refer to as cocktail party identity. You know, somebody comes up to you at a party and says, "So what do you do?" Well, yeah, for years I was able to say, "Hey, I work for the Wall Street Journal."
Uh-huh.
Yeah, worked. Yeah, worked. And suddenly I was like, I don't know. What am I doing? You know, I'm failing at writing novels, you know. So I started actually freelancing magazine pieces because I wanted to keep my name out.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wanted to keep in the world of journalism so that, you know, if I ever wanted to go back in, I could. I found, much to my surprise, that even coming from the Wall Street Journal, where, you know, back then at least, the features were about as close to magazine style writing as any newspaper features could come. I found huge resistance from editors as to whether or not, you know, I could actually write magazine pieces. So yeah, prove it. You know, prove it that you can write magazine pieces. So I started doing magazine pieces in part out of complete contrarianness, because if you're telling me that you don't think I can do it, I'm going to prove to you that I can. You know, I've always been contrary. That's why I got the job at the Journal. You know, that's when, you know, started writing magazine pieces. And I found actually that I really got into writing those long magazine pieces. I really enjoyed the process. I enjoyed the storytelling, the structure, You know, it's a whole lot different. You know, it's like you're thinking of writing a long piece is really you have to think in terms of chapters and scenes, unlike in even long newspaper pieces.
Yeah.
You got to think in terms of chapters and scenes, and I really enjoyed that. But then it also came to feel that while I'm working on these pieces, you know, I did a piece for the Atlantic Monthly about tracking the travels of a particular model of handgun.
Yeah.
And what my goal was to sort of show what the forces were that put this gun in the hands of a kid in Virginia Beach, Virginia, who then used the gun to kill a teacher. This is like the forerunner of things we see every other day.
I was reading last night, and it was sort of breathtaking how modern. I mean, you could update some details in the type of gun and a few other things and publish it today, except it was 30,000 words.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, nothing had changed. Yeah. So the thing about that piece was, it was such a long piece. It was such a, I mean, I loved writing it, but in order to cover all the ground that I had to write, I mean, this was a long piece when I sent it. I can't remember how many pages, it was like 50 pages or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been trying to cut it down, you know, cut. And I remember talking to my wife one night, I was just like, you know, despondent. I said, you know, I can't get this thing down. Now, you know, the Atlantic had already bought the idea. They hadn't bought the piece yet. They hadn't read the piece yet. You know, they just approved my query.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, well, look, you know, you really don't have an option. Just send it. Send it in. Next day I always send things by FedEx because you need to get rid of that anxiety that they never got it. You know, you can always track FedEx. But believe me, that was one of the big deals.
This is like pre-emailing it.
Yeah, it's pre-email, but still, even with email, you know, you want to make sure that somebody got it.
Yeah.
And that's you got it, you know, there's always going to be that little terror that, you know, even with email, that it wound up in somebody's inbox on a day when he or she got like 5,000 emails and never saw it.
Huh.
You know what I mean? So I sent it by FedEx, gets there. So it wasn't really, couldn't have been within 24 hours, but within 48 hours, I get a call from the editor-in-chief. I can't remember his name. I've ever been so grateful to him ever since. He called me up and he says, we love it. We're going to take the whole thing. He said, but it'd be nice if you could find some cuts. So I was like, oh, my God, this is great. But then as, you know, as I started doing magazine stuff, and realizing that there, too, all the work that I was doing really was essentially about as much as I would do if I was doing a book. So prior to that gun story, I had done a series of pieces in part for Harper's and for others about how companies spied on individual consumers, a series of essay-ish reports.
Yeah, it was another one that struck me as very prescient of what's happening today. It was like with junk mail and database tracking and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that was a book called The Naked Consumer. Yeah. How companies targeted individuals and even in one case how they sort of manipulated TV advertising. And also this one guy, charming guy, I love this guy, whose company would like put people in stores and have them follow consumers around, you know, without the consumers actually being aware, to sort of identify everything they touched, everything they did, and so forth. It's a fascinating thing. So that was the first point where I realized, wait a minute, I'm doing all this stuff. One day I had this epiphany. It was a strange moment because I had lived in Baltimore, had moved back to San Francisco when our lives really sort of started to fall apart. The high point of that year was the 1989 earthquake.
That gives
you an idea. That was the high point. And suddenly we had two small kids in a tiny house. It was just like, I made $9,000 that year. So anyway.
Freelancing.
from everything, yeah. But anyway, I was sitting there in my office in Baltimore. We had actually moved from Baltimore to San Francisco, then back to Baltimore, believe it or not, because it seemed like a safe haven, you know, apart from atrocious amounts of crime, safe haven for the family in terms of neighborhood and so forth. My wife, they sweetened an offer for her, made her a division chief. So we came back to Baltimore. I didn't want to be back. And one afternoon, I was sitting on the phone talking to my editor at a magazine, really good editor, but he talked a lot. And so we were on the phone. And as I was talking to him, I fell asleep. Fell asleep at my desk. It was, you know, a hot, sultry day. I just fell asleep at my desk. I woke up probably like, you know, 5-10 seconds later, right? He was still talking. End of that conversation, I said, okay, this is it. this is it. This is, I'm done. I'm doing my book. I'm doing a book. And by the end of the day, I was working on my first book proposal, which became that book about consumer espionage, the naked consumer. And then I went through the exercise again with the gun book, realizing then, you know, this could really make a good book. The reception was so huge. And so that's what followed.
Both of those books, as far as I could tell, looking back, were well received. Particularly, the gun book was very well received.
Gun book was very well received. The first book, nobody read, nobody bought. One guy reviewed. It was like they did nothing for that book. They did nothing for that book.
And so, you could have, I feels like at that point, gone down a journalistic path of. That a lot of people do, including a lot of people we've had on this show who, you know, they do magazine pieces, maybe they get a contract for a few, then they do a book, they kind of rotate them in and out. And I'm really interested in the point at which you sort of turn to history, or, I mean, was there an epiphany there, a moment there where you said, I actually don't want to interview live people anymore?
Yeah, I much prefer dealing with the dead. Yeah,
did you realize that, or did you stumble into it?
Yeah, well, here's what happened. I mean, first of all, the first two books, The Naked Consumer and the gun book, Lethal Passage, were contemporary stories, issues. The first, there was not there were elements of kind of narrative structure, storytelling in the first book, but they were on a chapter by chapter basis. The next one, Lethal Passage, there was a lot more sort of narrative drive, but still it wasn't classic. You know, storytelling. It was getting there. And then I happened to read a book. It was a novel, The Alienist by Caleb Carr.
I've read that book.
It would have been 1994, I think. Loved the book, but what I loved about that book was its evocation of old New York. Yeah. So I've always had a thing for New York. I left that book, having enjoyed, of course, the whole serial killer thing and the alienist concept. But what I really liked was that feeling of that I really had kind of lived back in the 90s, I think, of in New York. So I thought to myself, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to try to do a nonfiction book about a historical murder that would evoke the same kind of feeling in me and in readers, mm-hmm. only it would be all true. So I started looking into murders. I remember the book that I took out. I took out a book from the library called The Encyclopedia of Murder. Started reading it, and started working my way through. I came across the serial killer in Devil in the White City, Holmes. Whether it was H or M for Mudgett, his real name, I can't remember, but had no interest in doing him because he was too over the top. It's like crime porn.
He's almost like hard to believe.
Yeah. So I want to do something more like something with like lots of character and manner, you know, less something like Gosford Park, that kind of thing, you know. And so I found a murder that I actually started looking into. It was bugging me though because it wasn't particularly mysterious. It was kind of funky. It would have made a great short piece for like American Heritage or something. But as I was doing the research for it, I happened to open a page in the New York World. The newspapers were sort of filed in a way where you would come, you'd finish one, and then you'd get the next one, and you'd see the front page right there. So, and here was this front page talking about a hurricane that had killed, the headline said, 2,000 people right in Texas. And I grew up on Long Island. I was a hurricane junkie. I mean, it was always sort of a love-hate thing because I lived in a fairly innovative house with lots of glass walls surrounded by tall trees. You know, I loved the trees, loved the house. Hurricanes, trees, glass walls don't mix, you know. So I was always this love-hate thing, but I loved hurricanes. But I knew nothing about this, you know, hurricane that had killed like 2,000 people in 1900. Yeah. So I figured, it's just the New York World exaggerating. Continued by reading the paper, got to the next paper, the estimate of 2,000 went up to 5,000, you know, and then for the next 3 weeks, it was just coverage in the paper of this tremendous storm that had destroyed the city of Galveston. And I thought to myself, whoa, I'm going to look into this. You know, I just hadn't committed yet to doing a book, but I started thinking about it, thinking, okay, how can I do this in a really powerful and dramatic way? And that's where my agent, David Black, I credit him a lot with actually having sort of transformed my career. Because he forced me to come up with a way of telling that story that was in narrative form and that was, while true, was very compelling. And I went through proposal draft after draft after draft, and I was so ready to dump my agent, but I just gave it one more shot, and I think he sensed that I was ready to bail, because he said, okay, we're done, we're ready, you know, we're going to send it to the publisher. And immediately the thing got bought by several people wanted it, and Crown Publishing got it. And and I don't want to be trite, but like, the rest was history. I mean, I just loved that approach to doing history, to finding all this great detail, finding characters, and making them work together in this nonfiction narrative that just drove toward this horrible, you know, finish. Mm-hmm. The thing I wrestled with, one of the things I wrestled with most, this was the old journalist in me having an issue, the conniption, was, again, this idea of why write about it now?
Right.
This is a hurricane that had struck in like 1900. Why am I doing this now? What is at the Wall Street Journal, we were trained to think in terms of a significance graph. You know, the point being is like three paragraphs down after the lead, you know, the question you were supposed to ask yourself is, okay, why should someone read this? That's what you had to convey in the third graph. You, Mr. Reader, here's why you should read this, because it's significant. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. There was nothing like that. I mean, except for the fact that there, you know, having said what I said about anniversaries, that was also tied to an anniversary.
Oh, really?
Although we came out a full year early, deliberately, because I wanted to beat any kind of anniversary
else
crush.
I see.
So we came out a full year early on that. But it was that question, why now? And I had to wrestle with that and get to the point where I remain now. And the point was, here's why I'm telling the story, because it's a hell of a story. And that was enough. You know, I had to get to that point where you tell a story because it's a good story, not because it has to have significance. It has to be a story that is going to make somebody cry or sit up and say, wow, I didn't know this stuff, mm-hmm. or that is going to lodge itself in somebody's mind for, you know, the rest of their lives, periodically coming back to, you know, the burning of the corpses on the beach in Galveston, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about the process around historical, you know, research and then writing about it. We, like, at the Atavist, we do historical pieces. We're like one of the few places that we don't peg things. So we've done some things from the 1800s. We've done some things in the early 20th century. And as an editor, it's challenging. I think the question you get asked all the time is sort of like, or people reference all the time, is sort of like, are you putting words in these people's mouths? And I know the answer to that question, which is like, it's written in the beginning of the book, which is like, everything that someone says is from a letter or whatever. The places where I find that it gets more difficult are sort of like description. Like, I was looking back at Devil in the White City, and there's really rich description of what something smelled like. He stepped onto the street and it smelled like this.
Peaches in the train station?
Yeah.
It's in an article.
What is the level of sort of like, it smells like that in that train station versus it smells like that in that train station that day?
Right. Yeah, that's actually a fairly tricky thing. And I wrestled with that. But my feeling was, you know, in the case of the train station with Holmes arriving, and I think that was the context of that particular thing. And frankly, I'm somewhat at a loss as to exactly what the resource was where I found the smell of peaches. But it was the kind of thing where the sense I got from the piece was that the ambient sense of peaches was pretty much an ambient sense of peaches. You know,
yeah.
You know, for that season. And so, you know, it sounded to me like that would be a nice thing to have in the piece to sort of awaken people's all their senses to what was happening at that particular moment.
Yeah.
Here's an odor. Scent is one of the most powerful things I think you can ever have in a piece, but it's very hard to come by unless you have somebody talking about it or otherwise. Another example of this kind of thing was like in Isaac Storm, where using the fire, the Sanborn fire insurance maps. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but every town back around the turn of the century, the company called the Sanborn Insurance Company had done these incredibly detailed maps of every community. I'm talking maps the size of a tabletop, about this thick, with every block, not only every block, every house on the block. And because it was for fire departments, every house was identified by the composition of the house, where the stove was, whether it had a fireplace, whether it had an outhouse, and so on. And every commercial building and its use was identified as well. So in the case of Isaac Klein, I knew that on a particular day he was coming, and I knew the direction of the wind and so forth. I knew he was coming in from the beach into town, and he was going past the coffee roastery and the wood planing mill. You know, and so I feel you can make certain observations about what the scent is in the air at a particular time because of the presence of those two things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have since sort of refined that to the point where unless I know it's actually happening at a certain point, I'm not gonna make a reference to it. My standards have actually gotten radically tighter over time.
Partly the books are getting so much attention that, like, you have to be able to go out into the world and make the argument, like, because people are going to say that. People are going to say, like, sure. Come on. You don't know that that happened. And you can say, yep, I've got it.
But you can also, I mean, there are certain things that you can, of course, observe. I mean, for example, if you're I don't even know if I mentioned this in Dead Wake, the Lusitania book, but, you know, if you are... if you're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on a ship, and I know this because I've done now two transatlantic voyages. The first was totally for the research. The second was after the book was done, but also to sort of collect some photographs and things to like tweet and so forth. Yeah, you know, the voyage taught me something that I had never really understood, and that is when you're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there is no odor of the sea. You don't smell the sea because there's nothing to smell. You know, it's when you get closer to land, you know, when you're close to the Irish coast, when you start, you know, smelling the sea where you know, the barrier between the sea and the land, where you get the sense of decay and, you know, kelp and rotting on the beach and, you know, the smell of the spring grass coming off the Irish coast. So you can make that observation almost at any point before you get close to Ireland.
Uh-huh.
So
right.
Sure. So I think you're absolutely on fair ground. The thing that I often find fascinating is that people will come to me and say, "Oh, but you have dialogue. You must have made that up, right?" Nobody reads the thing I put in the front of the book. I don't even know why I bother, you know, but it's there, right? About the fact that everything between quotes is, you know, from a letter or whatever. But it's, in a way, it's a very reassuring sort of thing. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, what's happening is the reader is taking what I provide him or her, which is most likely not going to be contiguous dialogue, but more like a couple of quotes in the space of three or four paragraphs.
Yeah.
But it's the reader's imagination that is making that into something that it's not, is making that into dialogue. It's coming to seem to that reader like dialogue. And I love that. You know, that's great.
Yeah.
But if you were to say, okay, now take a closer look at that and tell me, and then read my footnotes and see, do you still think that that's dialogue? Well, obviously it's not.
You have to have your own standards for it. Like, no one's really going to police the smells, and I guess someone could go look up all the research, but they have to work.
Yes, they will.
They will.
And they do.
But then
they do.
It's like almost an existential question in some ways. Like, you could drive yourself crazy saying, like, okay, did he smell that on that day, or did this happen on this day? But you're also trying to create a mood, so you need those details. But you can't, if at any point you say to yourself, who cares if he did or didn't, on that day, then it all falls apart because the whole foundation of it is, then you're sort of lost in like, well, why am I not just making up a bunch of it?
Sure, sure.
It just seems like a very...
No, but it also depends very, very much on actually how you say it.
Yeah.
If you're saying that, you know, in the course of a transatlantic voyage, you know, you never smell the ocean, and it's in that sort of context among five other observations about the ship and so forth, you know, that's fine. What you can't do is have a character say, like character, you know, John. You can't have John saying he realized that there was no odor of the sea, mm-hmm. because that's a completely different thing. That's fiction.
Right.
And
you're
imputing thoughts and so forth. I often hear that a lot from people also saying, well, you know, you must be making up this because, you know, you're telling about how somebody felt, or you're talking about somebody being angry and so forth. No, I mean, I will only do that. I will only impute. First of all, I almost never do, but I will only do so if I know that somebody's annoyed or what somebody is feeling.
Like, they've recorded that. They have
recorded that in a diary or a letter, or you don't have to read very deeply into Wilson's love letters to his girlfriend, you know, for this last book, uh-huh. to get a sense of, you know, passion and the fact that this guy is like totally besotted. It's there on the page. But by the same token, you don't even have to say anything at all about how he was feeling, because it's there in the writing. So you just present the girlfriend, the letters to the girlfriend.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, right.
And then the reader comes to realize, oh yeah, so he was feeling X, Y, Z.
And in terms of these characters, I mean, you did three books in a row. Again, I don't know about the new one, but that had, in some sense, a double thread to them. And one of them that was sort of one story was, I mean, you have a father and a daughter, and then there's also sort of like all the Nazis. Did you sort of settle on that as an idea for how to tell a story and then put it together, or did that come out of the research?
There's a presumption that this is my shtick. It's the dual narrative, and this is what I set out to do all the time. You know?
Especially two of them kind of had a very
two
like
of them,
murder
and unfortunately, they were back to back. The first was The Devil in the White City, and that was a completely organic evolution of the plot. Because I realized very quickly that you know, the thing that I felt originally about Holmes, about crime, porn, and so forth, I still felt. I didn't want to write a book just about Holmes and porn. I mean, what you'd then have simply is a period Silence of the Lambs, you know? I mean, it just was uninteresting to me. But it was when I, during the course of the research, when I started reading about the World's Fair, that's when I thought to myself, I love this. The first fact, in fact, that really, really won me to the World's Fair was the fact that Juicy Fruit gum was introduced to consumers at the World's Fair of 1893.
Uh-huh.
And I love Juicy Fruit gum, always have. And I thought to myself, no shit, you know, 100 years? I mean, this thing has been around for that long? And then the more I read and the more I saw, you know, who had turned up at the fair, that just about everybody who was anybody.
Yeah.
And I realized then, within 24 hours of reading about the fair, the title Devil in the White City came to me and stayed throughout the whole thing. What I realized then and there, that afternoon, the thing that was going to make this interesting was the juxtaposition of sort of light and dark, you know, good and evil. This monument to civic goodwill versus, you know, juxtaposed against this monument to the dark side of human nature. At the same time, virtually the same place. We're talking blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, yeah, this is what's going to make it compelling.
Like, that's the tension.
Yeah. And
that's
going to
drive it.
But it was really hard to pull off. And frankly, on the eve of publication, I was pretty convinced that my career was over, because I'd violated, in my view, every single, you know, concept of good narrative. And, you know, the two stories never touch. You know, they never really intersect,
mm-hmm.
except for the existence of the fair. And there's one place where they actually do cross. But otherwise, it was these two stories, and it was, I thought I was just going to get savaged, you know, by everybody. But happily, I was
wrong. It didn't
actually
turn out that way.
No.
But then did you fear the kind of shtick label?
When the second book came along, yes. Yeah. Here's how the second book came out. In fact, I almost didn't do the second book because I was afraid that the whole shtick thing would be leveled against me. This, you know, idea, oh, he's doing this derivative story, you know, and all that stuff. Derivative of himself, no less. But the way that, you know, I'm talking about Thunderstruck, which is about Marconi and the second most famous murderer in English history, Crippen, Holly Harvey Crippen, was that the way I discovered the idea was when I read in a timeline about wireless and Marconi, I came across a reference to this killer, Crippen, who I had known about for a long time.
From your Encyclopedia of Murder?
No.
No.
No. I'm sure he was in there. But my guess, the nearest I can put things together in my forensically about when I first heard of Crippen was when I was 13. My mother was a big mystery lover. Huh. And I remember, my sisters say, oh, you're full of shit. But I remember standing in my kitchen in Freeport, Long Island, as my mother told me the story of Crippen. And as near as I can guess, I'm thinking it must have been on the day when the death of the sea captain involved was announced was his obit was uh-huh. run in the Times. Because, you know, why else would she have told me about this whole thing then? So fast forward, here I am in Seattle. I had started reading about Marconi and wireless because I had gotten cut off on a very precarious drawbridge in Seattle by somebody who was on a cell phone. And I was so pissed. And then I looked up and I happened to see a cell phone tower and I thought, hey, wireless. You know, this is, now we got all these cell phones. This might be an interesting thing to explore. In that timeline, came across that the name Crippen, and I had no idea how the hell does this guy end up on a timeline involving Marconi and wireless. So I started looking into it. That's when I learned about this transatlantic chase with Crippen fleeing England and thinking he's home free, followed by Scotland Yard with the whole world being essentially aware of everything that's going on the ship, on the killer's ship, because of wireless. But the killer has no clue. You know, I just loved this idea. And I was like, oh, man, here we go again. The, you know, dual narrative central. And that's why I did that book that way, because uh-huh. I loved that final, the final 100 pages of that book are probably the best 100 pages that I've ever written.
Oh, wow.
So,
does the new one have a dual narrative?
Well, then you see, it's like if you believe in ghosts, you can find them, evidence of them everywhere, you know? It's like, okay, so the first two, definitely dual narratives. Isaac Storm, you could even argue, was a dual narrative, you know? You got the weatherman, you got the storm, and you got this conflict, right?
Right.
I don't see it that way. I see it just as that's the story. And so after Thunderstruck, which is clearly a dual narrative, you know, then came in the Garden of Beasts. Right? In the Garden of Beasts. And is that a dual narrative? Well, it's got the Nazis, it's got the ambassador, it's got the daughter. You could say it's a dual narrative, but it's not. It's like any novel. It's nonfiction, but it's like you read any novel, you're going to have multiple characters.
Right. It's got a plot. It's got characters.
It's got a plot. You got multiple characters. You got conflict. Are those dual narratives? No. So is In the Garden of Beasts, a dual narrative? No. Is the Lusitania? You know, people are going to see it again because you got the Lusitania, you got the submarine, and they're in juxtaposition in a very, I think, very, very compelling way.
Right.
Because, you know, in this case, I died and went to heaven with all this material to choose from for Dead Wake. Because, you know, here you got the submarine commander, and I've got his war log, you know, this day by day, hour by hour account of his entire voyage from Germany. Mm-hmm. So you can build suspense with that.
Yeah.
Converging on this, you know, giant ship of Lusitania. So is that a dual narrative? No. It's a story.
Yeah. Following chronology from different people's perspectives. Do you feel pressure in the sort of success realm? I mean, obviously you want to write the best book you can write, and you have your own standards for that. They're obviously going to print a bunch of copies because right. you passed them sold a bunch of copies. And does that affect you? Does that impact you as you're writing the book? Or in some ways it's easier to work in obscurity, I guess is what I'm saying, is like it's easier to just focus on the work if there's not a sort of industrial machine that is also expecting your work to like show up and like make them money.
Obviously. But again, it's like, you know, once I embark on a project, I just really, really try very hard to put it out of my head what anybody's expectations or hopes are and just hope for the best. You know, like I'm working on a test proposal now for my next project, which I will not tell you what it's about. I never do. But this is a project that... you know, I might get some pushback from. I don't know. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It charms me, and if it charms me, it's going to charm somebody else, you know. But it's at some point you got to just do the sort of like Devil in the White City. I mean, if luckily I had an editor and a support structure at Crown, where they saw in that book the potential for a really great seller. Mm-hmm. I think, and I don't even know why they would see that, but you know, it came on the heels of a book that had done very well, you know, Isaac Storm, and maybe this was a vote of confidence, you know, a Hail Mary pass on their part, I don't know. But, you know, if you think about it rationally, I think if I had tried to pitch that idea cold with no track record to a publisher, I don't think it would ever would have been published, mm-hmm. you know. But you just have to keep that stuff out of your mind to the extent that you can. And that's why I try to keep things out of my mind that I know I can keep out of my mind, like reviews.
Right.
You know, I keep that stuff out of my, and that's why also I never tell anybody what ideas I'm working on. Yeah. Because, and it's not because I'm afraid somebody's going to steal it, not at all. It's more like if I told you, you know, what this next thing I'm working on, I'm a terrible oral pitcher. You know, I couldn't convey the thing in the rich detail that I can in a book proposal. So if I told you at a party what I'm working on, you would, and if you didn't, you know, if you looked at me and your face fell flat, like, oh, why would you do that, really? You know, it hurts.
Yeah.
You know, it hurts your thinking.
Yeah.
And there's no way to avoid it. I marvel at the writer friends that I have who, they'll talk about everything in detail. You know, they're stronger than I am. They're tougher. They're tougher. I'm a wimp.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
And excited for the new book and the one after. Even greater mystery as to what it is. But the new one's called Dead Wake.
Yeah, good, good. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Long Form. I'm Max Linsky, not Evan Ratliff. Evan is on a beach somewhere, which means I get to thank him for that fantastic interview. Evan, thank you, sir. Thanks also to Eric Larson for taking the time. His new book is called Deadwake. You should procure it. Our third host is Aaron Lammer. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Rachel Mabe. Thanks so much to our sponsors, the great folks at Tiny Letter who continue to support us. Go get yourself a Tiny Letter. If you need something to write about in your Tiny Letter, pick up the new book from Michael Paternetti. It's called Love and Other Ways of Dying. There is no one better than Paternetti. Go get this book. And finally, check out our new friends at Wealthfront. Wealthfront.com/longform. They're going to change the way you invest your money. Thanks so much to them for sponsoring the show. And we'll see you next week.